I graduated. As part of my requirements for graduating, I took an internship at a state-of-the-art health club in Greensboro. The tennis instructor there was a guy named Vic, who was tall, with curly blonde hair and dimples, clean-cut, athletic, and polite. It didn't take long for me to develop a crush on him. I wasn't looking for anything serious, but maybe part of the road back for me was having a relationship with a nice guy. If I could do that, I thought, maybe it meant I wasn't so damaged. One night I was in my apartment in Burlington and someone came knocking on my door. I asked who was there, and he said, "It's me, Vic." My heart sped up with excitement. I was so flattered. I opened the door and he came stumbling in. We sat downstairs and talked, and it became clear that he was really inebriated. I told him I needed him to leave. He begged me to let him stay the night. "Please, I'm so drunk, I can't drive," he slurred at me. I finally agreed he could stay on my couch. I brought him a blanket and some water, and then I went upstairs to bed. I was in there maybe 20 minutes or so when, all of a sudden, Vic opened my door and climbed into bed with me. I had to fight him off, and it was truly a physical fight. I screamed and kicked and pushed until he got up off me, calling me tease and slut, weaving his way down the stairs to the door. "Get the fuck out, you son of a bitch," I yelled. "Get out!" I bolted the door behind him and threw my fist at the door, then slid down the front of it, hugging my knees to my chest and weeping. I called a girlfriend from the health club, one who was always up for partying. She drove over and we drank beer, and I cried some more and went on about how much I hated men. At some point, the decision was made to go get some coke. So we got in my car and drove to Chapel Hill around 2 a.m., to a basement student apartment, a friend of her friend's. A young man opened the door. There were lots of people inside his apartment. I handed over $50, and he handed me a small plastic bag. He didn't let go of it, though. He narrowed his eyes at me. "Don't tell anybody where you got this," he said. I nodded, and he released the bag. Back at my apartment, my friend decided we should invite more people over to party. I inhaled my lines and told myself I was getting everything under control. I felt the numbness on my teeth and the back of my throat spread. I hated myself, and I hated my life, but for a short time the coke made me not care. I simply shrugged, and until 7 or 8 the next morning, various people I did not know dropped by my apartment to drink beer and do coke, disappearing for a while upstairs. When the sunlight began streaming in, my friend left with a guy and my apartment was empty. I left the beer cans and full ashtrays on the table and went up to my bed. At least the night was over. I was supposed to work at 2 p.m., but I couldn't get out of bed. I lay there for hours crying, disgusted with myself. I stared at the phone, knowing I should pick it up and mumble an excuse about being sick, but I didn't care. The entire day I stayed in bed, crying. I decided that day, even though I was not going to marry Paul and I was not graduating with a 4.0, I had to recreate myself somehow. Because if I went on like this, I would kill myself. And if I died, it would mean that the moment when Ronald Cotton sprung up from the darkness and into my life threatening to kill me had defined me. It would mean he had won, that he really did kill me that night, and I hated him too much to let him win. A few weeks later, a girl I knew from Elon convinced me to go down to Florida with her for spring break. "It'll be good for you," she said. Looking back now, I can't believe I had just come out of a rape trial and agreed to go to Fort Lauderdale. I went down there with the absolute worst intestinal flu in my life and never left my room for the first 3 days. Instead, I stared out through the balcony doors at the drab squatness of the cheap hotel surrounding us, listening to the noise that rose up from the streets, gunning motorcycles, hooting frat boys, and squealing women that muted even the crashing surf shimmering on the horizon. When I ventured out at last, I wore gray jeans, a sweater, and white sneakers, hoping I would not attract any kind of sexual attention. In fact, among all the miniskirts and girls in halter tops, I hoped I was invisible. While my friend and her boyfriend got airbrushed shirts with their names on them, I stepped inside a bar so I wouldn't be standing out in the street with roaming packs of drunken men and women. But I was only there for a few minutes when a dark-haired guy wearing sunglasses came up to me and said, "Hey, can I get you a drink?" I thought he was cute. He reminded me of Don Johnson, so I said, "Sure." Instead of returning to the bar, he simply handed me his. A comedian, I thought. I held his half-full drink and looked at him like, "Thanks." Then he said, "You want a cigarette?" And I said, "Sure," to play along, so he took the one he was smoking and handed it to me. Then he asked me if I wanted to dance. I laughed and said, "Are you going to stand there and dance for me now?" He grinned at me, took the drink and the cigarette and put them down, and grabbed me by the hand. "No, let's really dance," he said. As we danced, we talked about where we were from. He was a graphic designer from Long Island, and he knew a girl I had gone to high school with. He was extremely polite. When the song ended, I told him I needed to get back to my friends, and he asked me if he could take me to dinner the next night. Guys on spring break didn't do that, so I was intrigued. I told him we could go to dinner, but if he touched me, I'd kill him. He put his hands up in the air in surrender and said, "You got it." We met up the following evening in the hotel restaurant. He ordered a strawberry daiquiri and steak and green beans, although I don't know why, since he proceeded to try and eat the chicken off my plate. I had never met anybody like him. He wore sunglasses and dangled a cigarette from his lips when he wasn't chewing Clorette's gum. He wore a blazer with a T-shirt, and he made me laugh. We kissed at the end of the night, and it was a kiss that made me feel innocent and hopeful again. It wasn't a kiss that demanded more, that pushed and prodded. I told him I was leaving the next day, and he asked me if he could take my friend and me to lunch before we left. The next day, he was so sunburned from lying out that he looked like a lobster, albeit a lobster with moosed hair and a calculated few days of stubble. He was still cute, even though he looked absolutely ridiculous. We had open-faced turkey sandwiches for lunch and played shuffleboard, and I gave him my address and phone number and didn't think too much about it. Figured I'd fly home and that would be it. It would just be a story. I'd met a guy named Vinny from New York. But I don't think I was home for 6 hours when the phone started ringing, and it was Vinny. We probably talked about every 3 hours for the first few weeks, and he wrote to me every day. The next month, he flew down to see me. He was absolutely crazy about me. He didn't jump on me and innately seemed to sense that I needed to be treated delicately. The following month, I decided to fly up to Long Island to visit him. I knew I had to tell him what had happened to me, because if he couldn't deal with it, I didn't want to invest anything more into Vinny from New York. We went on a walk from his house toward the canals in Brightwater, a flat 8-mile walk. At times, we could see clear to the ocean. I told him that I had been raped at my college and my case had gone to trial. I braced myself for hostility and judgment, but there was none.
"What happened to the guy?" he asked.
"He got life in prison," I said.
"Good. That's what he deserves," he said.
We had stopped right in front of a Friendly's, and as he held me tight, I stared at the window where you could walk up and order an ice cream cone. Was Vinny really strong enough to hold on to me? Or would he run away, the way Paul had? The sacred lie in my moving on was that I had simply learned to live with the continued presence of Ronald Cotton, pushing him to the edges of my life when I could. By June, when I graduated, with Vincent telling me how in love with me he was, we made a plan that I would move up to Long Island to be with him. I was desperate to get as far away from Burlington as I could. I excitedly packed up my apartment, and in those final days, Paul dropped by to say goodbye.
"I just want you to know," he said, "that I'm so sorry for the way things turned out. I still really care about you, Jennifer. I always will."
"Me too," I said, and we hugged each other.
"I wish things had been different."
"Me too," I said.
"I never even told you, but I had already put our names into the lottery for married student housing," he said.
We both felt the sting in that, at how close we had once been to making those kinds of decisions, and how life had jumped the tracks because of a violent assault, not something we had chosen. In the end, we were both cheated. It was incredibly painful. I drove off with Burlington in my rear-view mirror, eager to start a new life with Vinny. But as safe as I felt with Vinny, I hated Long Island. I missed the South terribly and told Vinny I was returning to North Carolina, with or without him. He told me I was his future, and he would go wherever I needed to be. When the ground thawed, we were gone. By spring of 1986, we moved into a condo in Winston-Salem, and I got a job in a bank. Vinny was creative and intelligent, and if darkness ever seized me, he could always crack me up and shake me out of it by running into a wall or suddenly falling on the floor. We did everything together, cleaned the house, hunted for antiques, took long walks. If I wanted him, he never left my side. One afternoon, as we were folding the laundry, Vinny said to me,
"I've been wondering about something."
"What?" I said.
"I've been wondering, Jennifer, would you marry me?"
I laughed at him because I wasn't sure if this was another of his jokes.
"Are you serious?" "I am most serious. Go look in the closet in your shoe," he said.
I gave him a skeptical look and went to my closet, where I found a diamond ring inside one of my shoes. He encircled me from behind.
"So, how about it?"
I turned to face him, tears in my eyes. "Yes, Vinny from New York, I will marry you." A few months into our engagement, Mike Golden called to say there would be another trial. I was shocked. I had no idea Ronald Cotton could have his conviction overturned. I was scared to death he'd go free. But Mike told me this time they would be trying my case together with the case of the second woman who had been assaulted that night. While I told Mike, of course, I would be there to testify, I resented it. I talked little of my rape to anyone in my new life. There was no need for people to know. And now here it came again. I had to explain to my boss at the bank that I would need to be out for a while. The last time, the trial had lasted 2 weeks. The DA's office put me up in a little creepy place that Vinny and I called the Bates Motel. I was terrified there, terrified that Ronald Cotton's family knew where I was and would come after me, despite the police stationed in the parking lot and Vinny at my side. In that awful avocado and gold room with the shag rug, in the town I had avoided like the plague, Vinny managed my extremes of don't touch me but don't leave me the best he could. The new prosecutor, Luke Turner, was very different from Jim Roberson. He was aloof and didn't appear interested in my emotional state, only how I could serve his case. I remember thinking the second woman was going to blow it and Ronald Cotton was going to walk. Mary Reynolds cried a lot and became very distraught to the point where she didn't make any sense. It was very difficult to hear what Mary had been through, and I was furious during the voir dire that Ronald Cotton's defense attorneys would try to point the finger at someone else, using a jailhouse snitch to do it, no less. There was never a doubt in my mind that Ronald Cotton was the man who assaulted me. It felt like they were just dragging things out. I watched bailiffs take Ronald Cotton away for a second time, his original sentence augmented by another term of life. "Good riddance, bastard," I thought. "May you burn in hell." Luke Turner thanked me for a job well done with a shake of the hand, and Mike hugged me and told me I deserved all the happiness in the world. About a year later, Vinnie and I got married. Then, in 1989, I discovered I was pregnant. I went in to the doctor, who put me at 12 weeks, yet I had already gained 21 pounds.
"What the heck are you eating?" the doctor joked.
The holiday season was coming, and he warned me to lay off the cookies and pie. But by Christmas, I needed to wear a full maternity dress. Vinnie knew I wasn't eating that much, and at 18 weeks, he accompanied me back to the doctor's for a sonogram. While we waited for the doctor in the examining room, we joked that I would be the woman on the cover of Newsweek giving birth to a 25-pound baby. It was either that or a fully grown 4-year-old. I was that big. The nurse came in and apologized that the doctor was running late. I had to pee incredibly badly because they made me drink a ton of water before the sonogram. Finally, the doctor came in and said the woman before me was having twins. That was the reason for his delay. They smeared the cold jelly on my enormous globe of a stomach, and we all stared at the screen. But the screen simply remained black as the nurse moved the instrument around, trying to find something.
"I can't find anything," she said.
The doctor told me to void half my bladder, and I returned only to have the same thing happen, a black screen telling us nothing. Finally, the doctor instructed me to empty my bladder completely. This time, the doctor himself performed the sonogram. We all peered intently at the screen until finally some gray blobs appeared.
"Oh, my goodness! Twins!" he suddenly said.
The nurse and Vinnie and I all stared at the monitor.
"Here's baby A's head and heart and feet and... there, you see that? That's baby B's head, heart, and little feet."
I looked to Vinnie to see if I could read his emotions, but Vinnie was still staring at the monitor.
"So if those are baby A's feet and those are baby B's," he said, "whose foot is that?"
He pointed to the upper corner of the screen. The nurse looked at him skeptically.
"What are you talking about?"
And this time the doc scanned up.
"Oh, my God," the nurse said. "There's another baby."
At this point, I did not want them to do any more scanning. I mean, how many could be in there? We were elated and in shock at the same time. I got dressed and we sat in the doctor's office. Bed rest, doctor's orders. So I returned home to wait and wait as I grew bigger and bigger. At 32 weeks, I went to the hospital. There are pictures of me, clutching a 64-ounce bottle of Maalox, wearing a brightly colored muumuu, and looking as if there was no part of me that hadn't expanded or stretched. The nurses would come in to roll me to one side to wash me, and then roll me to the other. For 2 weeks, I did not move from the bed, but seemed to grow by the minute, and finally, at 34 weeks, they performed a C-section. I had 3 beautiful babies, each so different and each so perfect. Morgan was tow-headed, blue-eyed, and coltish. Brittany, brunette, with deep brown eyes like mine that seemed intense and introspective from the day she was born. And my son Blake had the dark good looks and charm of his father. With our triple dose of happiness, we moved into a brick ranch house on Archer Road in Winston-Salem. There was nothing grand about it, but I had everything I wanted. A fenced-in yard, a bedroom across the hall from my babies, and a little deck off the kitchen where we laid down astroturf and put up netting so Morgan, Brittany, and Blake could play outside and not get splinters. It was a happy house, a house where I kissed away scraped knees and bee stings, a house where they wrote their first words in chalk on the sidewalk out front. Only at night, when the kids were sleeping soundly in their beds and Vinnie slumbered at my side, would I still shake with fear, hearing footsteps in the house, seeing shapes in the dark, and always his face. The hateful face of Ronald Cotton floating above mine. I prayed hard for the kids that I could keep them safe. As long as he was locked away for life, he couldn't hurt us, I reminded myself. Over the years, my nighttime fears subsided somewhat. But I still prayed each and every day for Ronald Cotton's violent death. Only then did I think that awful face might retreat back into the shadowy evil he had emerged from, and I would finally be free. So what the hell could Mike be coming to tell me? Vinny stayed home the next day so he could be there when Mike Golden and Rob Johnson arrived. The kids were at preschool, right around the corner, at the same place where I had gone to kindergarten. I opened the door and hugged Mike. Mike shook hands with Vinny, and then he introduced us to Rob Johnson. Rob was shorter than Mike, dressed beautifully in a blue suit. He had a round face with brown hair thinning on the top and graying at the temples, and he had large wire-framed glasses. He reminded me of Tommy Lee Jones. Mike looked like he had barely aged. He still had a thick head of wavy brown hair. About the only thing that showed the passage of 11 years were the lines that fanned out from the corners of his eyes. He had on a pair of slacks and a brown tweed jacket with a blue button-down. I suggested we sit out on the back porch. It was a warm day for March, and I brought out some iced tea and glasses on a tray. It's funny, the pleasantries you try to maintain in an effort to keep the anxiety, which wants to run around the room breaking things, under control. We sipped our iced tea and talked about the sunshine, the weather, and current events. Vinny and I looked at the two men, waiting. "Look, Jennifer, I hate bringing this up, but Ronald Cotton has some new attorneys, and they filed a motion, and we feel that we need to cooperate with it." My anger and disgust turned the sweet tea bitter. When would this ever go away? "Well, what does that have to do with me?" I said. "I don't want to go back to court. I can't go again. I'm finally getting to a point where I can put this past me, and I've got small kids now." "They want to have some testing done," Mike said, looking to Rob Johnson for help. "Mrs. Canino, have you ever heard of DNA?" Rob said.
"Like the O.J. Simpson stuff?"
"That's exactly right. There's a new test that can analyze biological evidence in the rape kit, and it's very accurate," Rob said. "Ronald Cotton has asked for a DNA test to be done on the rape kit," Mike informed me. "The problem is your blood sample has disintegrated since 1984. We need a new sample of blood from you so we can figure out what DNA belongs to you and what DNA belongs to the man who attacked you."
You know, every time I think I'm really moving on, something pulls me back. The other night, Vinny and I were watching basketball, and one of the players, Scottie Pippen, his face. I made Vinny turn it off because he looked so much like Ronald Cotton to me. And no matter how far I think I get, I still wake up from nightmares with that face in my mind. Mike is the kind of guy who loved being a cop because he loved helping people, and I could tell that this day was one of the few in his life when he probably hated his job.
"We hope this test will put it to rest forever," he said.
"But why? Why do I have to do this? Why do I have to go through this again?" I asked. "I'm supposed to be the victim."
"Mrs. Canino, it's important for you to know you don't have to consent to a blood sample," Rob said. "At least not yet. But his attorneys could get a court order down the line." "Look, we all know it's not going to change anything. It's just a last attempt. We got the right guy," Mike said. "Ronald Cotton is going to stay put in prison, but they could drag this thing out."
I couldn't believe how unfair it all was, that a twice-convicted rapist who was supposed to be sent away to die in prison could keep messing with my life. Weren't the two trials enough? There was a part of me that wanted to say, "Screw it, his lawyers are going to have to come with a search warrant before they get a drop of my blood." And this, I thought, looking out at our neatly mowed lawn and the tricycle parked by the garden, this is mine,
and Ronald Cotton has no right to encroach on any of it. Still, the thought that this would go on any longer, that it would keep coming back into my life, was enough to make me agree. If this would finally make it go away, then I'd comply. I looked up at them. "Okay, I'll do it, but I want to do it right away. Can you take it today?" Rob and Mike looked at each other with a mixture of surprise and relief. Relief, because I think they wanted this to go away as quickly as possible, too, but thought I might need some time to stew over it. Mike said he would make a few calls. In the end, law enforcement officials from Forsyth County gave Mike a rape kit, and they drove me to my doctor's office in downtown Winston-Salem. Vinny stayed home so he could pick up the kids from preschool and feed them lunch. Mike drove, and Rob insisted I sit in front, so he got in the back seat. Passing Forsyth Hospital, I pointed at it and told him it was where I had had the kids. I watched the vial fill up with my blood. It only took a minute, and then the nurse capped it and placed it in a bag and gave it to Mike. We exited the medical building, and Mike said, "We should get you some food." He looked around, and I guess we all saw the Pie Works pizza place across the street at the same time. "Pizza?" he said. With my blood in a bag between them, Rob and Mike sat on one side of a booth, and I sat on the other, and we tore into a large cheese pizza with half-and-half toppings, half black bean for me and half meat for the guys. Mike and Rob dropped me off at home a half-hour later. When I walked into the house, I heard, "Mommy!" and suddenly had three babies throw themselves at me. I bent down to scoop them up in my arms, hugging them tight and breathing in the wonderful, clean downiness of their hair. It was done.
Chapter 12. Ronald. June 1995. "Cotton, come here a minute. The warden wants to see you," said a CO, calling me to the door. He was a friendly black guy, about 5'7", with a thick mustache and curly hair. I was in my dorm for the night, having finished work and had my shower. I was relaxing with some of the other guys watching TV. A couple of them raised their eyebrows at me. "The only time you go to the warden is for discipline." I couldn't think of any rules or regulations I had broken or anything I had witnessed. I got up and locked my locker before heading over to the CO, worried that there had been a death in the family. It was the only other possibility. The warden's office had a couple of filing cabinets and a big brown wooden desk. The warden sat behind it with the look of a man who had something on his mind. He was white, on the skinny side, with brownish-blonde hair and a mustache. He was wearing a blue-striped shirt. He leaned back in his leather chair. "Have a seat," he said, gesturing at the metal chair in front of his desk. He nodded at the corrections officer who brought me in. The officer stepped outside and waited in the hallway. "Mr. Cotton, I've got good news and bad news. Which do you want to hear first?" I took a deep breath. "The bad news." I prepared myself, looking around at the framed certificates on the wall and the print of flowers that no doubt was supposed to cheer up the place. One of my sisters had written me earlier to tell me that she had ended up in the hospital after she had some trouble with her boyfriend. I could not help but wonder if the warden was about to tell me my sister had been killed. "Bad news is you're going back to court," he said. While I was relieved that the warden did not tell me anyone had died, I wasn't sure what to think about going back to court. Given my history, going back to court might not be a good thing. Who knows? Maybe there were new charges against me. More women that had said I raped them. I looked at him, waiting for the second part. "The good news is the guy that committed the crime you're doing time for confessed. You're going home tomorrow." I couldn't speak. Was he bullshitting me? How could I be here all these years and then, just like that, I'm going home tomorrow? It made me suspicious. I doubted Poole had suddenly gotten a conscience. I wish I could talk to my attorneys. The warden leaned forward in his seat, placing his arms on the desk. And because you're going home, what I want you to do for me is tell me what officers are running the drugs in here. I know you know. Just tell me their names. I looked back at him, thinking how friendly he was trying to be, like we were one and the same, guys who would do each other favors. I knew a lot of officers that did things for certain inmates they trusted. Things they didn't have to, things they could have lost their jobs for. One of the older COs from Greensboro used to pass me a can of Budweiser every now and then. Got a son in prison, he used to say. I'm not going to be your snitch, I said. If you want to find out, that's your job. The warden's friendliness quickly disappeared. Obviously, he was a man used to getting what he wanted. He was not happy at all. Take him back to his dorm, he yelled to the CO outside. As the CO walked me back, I tried to ask him if he knew anything more. Can't say I know you're going home, but I do know for sure you're going back to court, he said. That really hit me. The motion Rich had filed, they must have got me a new trial. Even if I was going back for yet another trial, at least I'd be housed in Graham, near my family. When I returned to the dorm, I looked at all the guys sitting around on their bunks at the table, waiting for time to pass. I think the grin on my face stretched from Tennessee to North Carolina. I spotted a buddy. Man, they said I'm going home tomorrow, I told him. For real. You serious? I knew you were telling the truth. I always knew you were innocent. I'm real glad for you, man. A couple more COs came over and told me to prepare my belongings because the North Carolina police would be coming to transport me in the morning. I went over to my locker and put everything in it on my bunk. I stared at all I had accumulated. By now, I had 3 radios, boxes of dentine gum, and enough soap to last me maybe 10 years. Canteen supplies. I also had a list of people who owed me money for canteen items. I took the list and one of my radios and found Blair, one of the guys who helped me out. Look, man, I'm going back to North Carolina, so take this. If you collect the money, it's yours, but don't get into any trouble collecting. If they can't pay, let it slide. And here, I said, handing him the radio I used to rent out for $1 a night. This is for you. I took more of my stuff from my bunk and started handing it out to the guys in my dorm like it was Christmas, and I was Santa. Jeremy, a long-haired white dude who was always in trouble for fighting, looked at me like I was nuts when I handed him another radio. A while back, he had stuck me in the arm with the pencil, although no lead had stuck. I knew he had nothing, no family. A young guy named Porter got the other radio. Some of the inmates gave me pictures of themselves signed Good Luck along with their names. I think they were afraid they'd be forgotten. In the end, all I decided to take for myself was a toothbrush and 6 months' worth of soap. I figured no matter what, I still needed to keep my teeth clean and my body fresh. I took another shower and lay on my bunk. I didn't sleep a wink, but lay awake all night, wondering what was really going on when I went back to North Carolina. In the morning, COs got me and brought me to a holding cell, and then 2 officers from the Asheville Prison Unit in North Carolina came to pick me up. They went through all my stuff to make sure I wasn't taking any contraband, and then they handcuffed me and put me in the back of a squad car. I wore a white T-shirt with a blue collar and a white pair of pants, the outfit of WTDC gave to its inmates who worked in the kitchen. It was clean, at least. My hair had grown pretty long, so I had a decent afro. There was just no time to cut it. They put my bag of soap, pictures, and letters in the trunk. They were 2 young guys, probably both in their early 30s. In fact, I thought we could be neck to neck in age. They wore sunglasses and full uniforms down to their shiny boots. One of them, the one with dark brown hair, drove the car. He had a strap around the back of his head to hold the sunglasses on. I thought I'd probably stare at that strap for many hours. We had a long drive. The other guy in the passenger seat had lighter brown hair. He broke the silence and turned. "We heard about your case," he said. The driver looked at me in his rear view. Is it true you spent 11 years locked up for something you didn't do? Yes, sir, I said. That's messed up, he said, shaking his head. A couple of hours into the trip, the officers talked about being hungry and where they should stop to eat. They exited off the freeway where there was a sign for gas and food. Let's go to McDonald's, the one in the passenger seat said. The driver pulled into the parking lot and parked the car. He turned to look at me over his shoulder. You hungry? He asked. I told him I was. I asked for a quarter pounder with cheese and fries, and the officer with the lighter hair went in to order while the dark-haired one and I sat down at a table outside. I placed my hands on the table. Sorry about those, said the darker-haired officer, looking down at the handcuffs on my wrists. Just following the protocol for transporting you. I looked around and noticed a couple a few tables away, staring at me. I'm sure they were wondering what the hell was going on with a man in handcuffs sitting at McDonald's. It was my first realization that people on the outside were going to have a lot of trouble understanding what had happened to me, since I didn't have a sign that read, innocent, on my forehead. And of course, I didn't look very innocent sitting there with handcuffs and an armed police officer. The other officer came over and set a tray down in front of me. I will never forget that first whiff of McDonald's fries after 11 years. It was exactly as I remembered it. And yet, it had never tasted so good before. It didn't take very long for me to get down my lunch. The officers laughed at me and asked if I wanted some more. I told them I didn't. I was so nervous and excited and jittery, I knew I had to pace myself or else I'd be sick. They also told me more about what they knew. We're really sorry for what happened to you. That guy shouldn't have waited so long, the light-haired one said, referring to Poole. Even after the DNA linked him, it still took him 5 hours to confess. That's what I heard. What a sorry SOB, said the other one. I was not surprised. Poole was not going to step up willingly to take responsibility for the crimes. That was clear long ago. God was finally taking care of things, just like my father had said. So listen, you're going home, but tonight you've got to stay in the Asheville prison because of the court schedule. Tomorrow we will take you to Alamance County and release you into their custody. I know it seems kind of cold, but it's just one more night, right? Said the light-haired one. I didn't have a choice. And they were right. What was one more night after I had spent so many behind bars? But that night in the Asheville prison, time had suddenly slowed down. There was a leaky sink in the cell, and each drop would have to grow to a certain size before it was heavy enough to spill off into the sink. I could feel every minute like that. Time collecting around itself until it was heavy enough to pass. I wanted to sleep, but I was too excited. I hadn't even bothered to make up my bunk. I just got up on the bare mattress and pulled the blanket over me, fully dressed with my shoes on. My feet hung over the edge of the bed like I was a fireman waiting on the bell. The same two officers came to get me when the sun came out. It climbed in the sky as we drove along the highway, promising a beautiful day. My mind still wondered if I was really going to be freed or if it was just a time cut, a reduction on my sentence, and I'd be imprisoned again back in North Carolina. The car rolled into downtown Graham, where the big courthouse with the statue in front of it rose up in front of us. This the courthouse? The light-haired cop said. That's where I was sentenced, but the district court is down the road. I knew from the jailer in Asheville that I would not be going to the superior court, but the new district court. I couldn't shake the fear that somehow this was a trick, that maybe I was being indicted on more charges. I had made this journey twice before. But this time we did not stop at the big marble courthouse in the middle of the traffic circle, which looked like it was watching you and judging you no matter which way around it you went. The police car continued down Elm Street to a brick building that housed a new court. And that's when I saw the news trucks. It was Friday, June 30th, 1995. I learned later that Fridays at district court were called zoo days, because it's the day when non-police cases are tried. It's just people, mothers and fathers making private charges against each other, but it became my Good Friday. The officers took me in with my bag and processed me. Ronald Cotton is no longer in the custody of the Department of Corrections. He is now in the custody of the Alamance County Sheriff's Office. A female bailiff received me into custody and put her handcuffs on me. The dark-haired officer spoke up. "That really necessary?" "I'm not taking those cuffs off," she said. "You want them off? The judge got to say so." The dark-haired cop looked at another bailiff, and he left to go find the judge. The judge came into the recess room. It was the same man who had presided over my probable cause hearing in August 1984, the same man who had increased the bond on all of my charges individually. His hair was now almost purely white, but still thick. He wore glasses and had a sharp, pointed nose like a beak. He didn't say a word to me, but told the female bailiff, "I give you a direct order to take the handcuffs off him." He waited until she had put them in the leather pouch on her belt, then swept out of the room. "Good luck," said the Asheville officers, and left. Next, a male bailiff, with hair slicked back like Dracula, brought me in a bag of clothes. "This is from your family. You can go into the restroom and change." "My family's here?" I said. He nodded. Inside the bathroom, I put on a purple shirt and black jeans. Later, I would learn my sister Tootie had gone shopping for them. The purple shirt hangs in my closet to this day. I sat in my new clothes, waiting, as maybe 15 or 20 minutes went by. Then the bailiff came back to get me. "You ready?" he said. I nodded. He brought me into the courtroom. It was much smaller than the one I had been tried and convicted in, and I realized immediately the news cameras were here for me. Tom and Rich stood at the defense table, and just behind them, my family. I did not see the women who had said I attacked them, only the faces of my mother, Diane, Tootie, Sheila, and some of my nephews. They beamed at me with happiness. A district attorney I had never seen before was opposite from us. The hearing was very short. Tom and Rich presented their motion for appropriate relief, then the prosecutor stood up and said the state joined in the motion, dismissing all charges. It was all happening so fast that it didn't feel real. Nothing was sinking in. "Mr. Cotton," the judge said, "the charges against you have been dropped. For the first time in a long time, you are walking out of here today a free man." Tom turned and shook my hand. Then Rich grabbed it. I know this more from watching the news coverage than actually having a memory of it. It felt kind of like falling back into the pond, like my ears were plugged up with water and everyone's voices were on the surface, distant. Diane told me she shrieked and threw her arms about my neck, hugging me for the first time in so many years. "Praise Jesus," she said, before the judge told her to get out of his court with that. The ADA, Rob Johnson, also turned to me and shook my hand, telling me he was sorry for everything I had been through on behalf of the state of North Carolina. Months later, I found out Mr. Johnson and the judge had made a special exception so I could simply walk out of the back of the courtroom that day, instead of returning to be deprocessed. As Tom and Rich led me down the aisle, faces on both sides turned to look at me. Many people had tears in their eyes. They were all kind of a blur. People were reaching out to shake my hand, shake Tom's hand, shake Rich's hand. Even Phil Mosley was there in the back, and Dan Monroe, and I swear I saw a bit of moisture in the corner of old Phil's eye. Everyone seemed to be on their feet, and I couldn't believe I was heading to the back door to the courtroom, the one that led out to the hallway and the public restrooms, and finally, the world outside. I walked numbly down the aisle, not sure how to take in what was happening. I had barely slept in 2 days. Before we opened that back door, Tom and Rich said they'd like to have a word and pulled me aside. The three of us kind of huddled together. I don't think I had ever seen Rich in a suit, but he was dressed in gray with a tie on and everything, and Tom looked like Matlock, a young Andy Griffith in a dark blue pinstripe suit. "Ron, it is our great pleasure to end our representation of you today," said Rich. "We've been working on this case for 3 years, and we never dreamed it would turn out like this." Tom continued, "We wanted to have a private moment with you just to reflect and be grateful for everything that's happened. In our careers, you don't see an injustice like this made right against all the odds." I hugged them, thinking this moment had so much meaning, as much meaning as the moment I was sentenced. I tried to pinch myself to make sure it wasn't a dream. I was really at a loss for words. "Thank you for the tremendous job you did for me. I know you didn't have to do any of it." I struggled. "I thank God that you took this case on. I don't know how I'll ever repay you. We don't want a dime for any of the work we've done, Ron. All we asked of you is to make the most of your freedom. Lead a productive life. That's the best payment we could ever ask for," Tom said. "Ready?" I nodded, and the three of us pushed open the courtroom door, where cameras flashed and people suddenly crowded around me. My sisters, Tootie, Diane, and Pig, along with my nephews, gathered around me. My mom clutched my arm like she was never going to let go. We walked outside in the summer sun. Before I went off with them, I turned to shake Rich's hand again, like my soul was shaking his. Someone got a picture of that. It's up on my wall. Walking away from the courthouse with my family, I looked up at the bright blue sky and said, "Lord, where do I go from here?"
Chapter 13. Jennifer. June 1995. Mike Golden and Rob Johnson returned to my house in June. This time we would not sit out on the deck off the kitchen and sip tea. The air was too thick, wrapping around you like a blanket the moment you stepped outside, so we stayed in where the air conditioner kept us cool. I have thought of Mike standing outside my door, sweating in the sticky June air, pausing for a minute before he knocked on the door. He had a job to do, yet he also knew he was about to completely shatter my world. He knew because it shook him in the same way. I could see it the moment he opened the door. In the months since March, I had thought very little about the lab results. They were another formality, another desperate lawyer tactic. We all knew the results would show what I had known all along, what I had always known. It was Ronald Cotton who had broken into my apartment on July 29, 1984, held a knife to my throat, and raped me. It was Ronald Cotton who threatened to kill me, who had chased me through the rain that night while I fled for my life. It was Ronald Cotton's face I had been seeing in my nightmares for the last 11 years. The neighbors' teenaged daughters took the triplets to the park earlier in the day, and Vinny stood next to me. Rob and Mike were very gentle when they delivered the news. The DNA found in Mary Reynolds' rape kit belonged to Bobby Leon Poole. It excluded Ronald Cotton. I shifted my hip to lean against the countertop, needed something solid to rest against, because it felt like my insides were unraveling. "What does that mean? How does it affect Jennifer?" Vinny asked stoically. I wasn't capable of asking rational questions. "It means we were wrong. Ronald Cotton was not your rapist," Mike said. As you know, during the trial in 1987, the cases were consolidated because the state knew the perpetrator was the same man, even though there was no DNA left to test in your kit, Rob explained. "We knew that Bobby Poole assaulted you, too." "But how do you know it's Bobby Poole?" Vinny asked.
Mr. and Mrs. Canino, Mike and Dexter Lowe went down to Central Prison to interview Bobby Poole. He knew details, Jennifer, Mike said, about breaking the light at your back door, about holding a flashlight in Mary's face, what you both were wearing. Details only the person who attacked you could know. I personally stood outside in the prison exercise yard in the blazing sun just a few days ago when they were interviewing Poole. I told them to be sure. Poole denied everything for a long time, Mrs. Canino, Rob said. But when he was told the DNA evidence identified him, he finally confessed and provided details about the crimes that assured us he was the perpetrator. Blood roared in my ears, an ocean of confusion crashing down on me, muffling their voices. Their faces searched mine, intent on discerning my emotional state. I can only imagine how difficult this must be for you. This is not your fault. We all made this mistake. I couldn't speak. I knew I had to keep it together in front of them, although it felt like everything I staked my life on, how I made sense of what happened to me, suddenly fell through a trap door. Silently, I berated myself. It meant I had screwed up. They had brought Bobby Poole into the courtroom during the second trial. How could I have been in the same room as my rapist and not recoil? I didn't even recognize him. Mike Galden was a first-rate cop who had risen through the ranks to captain from the young detective I met that awful night in the hospital, someone who had always treated me with dignity and respect. I had brought disgrace upon his investigation and the whole Burlington Police Department. What did he think of me now?
Jennifer, Ronald Cotton is going to be released from prison, Mike said.
When?
Vinny asked.
We're going to get him out of there as quickly as possible, Rob said. Alamance County has no interest in keeping an innocent man behind bars. Ronald Cotton will not spend another night in prison that he doesn't have to.
Somehow I managed to mumble a thank you to the district attorney and to Mike for their professionalism, and they walked out my door to leave me in a world that suddenly made no sense at all. For the first few days, I tried to keep patterns. I would get the triplets up, make their breakfast, load the dishwasher. Then I could move on to the routine afternoon tasks, vacuuming, making beds. As long as I stuck to my role of being a mom, I could hold myself together. Allowing myself to think outside of that was dangerous. Mike Galden phoned me to let me know the date Ronald Cotton would be released, and I watched a brief news item about it on WXI Channel 10. I have to say that the guilt over my part in robbing this man of so many years was not my first concern. Fear had opened up its maw and swallowed me whole. It was a fear even greater than what I felt in those early weeks before his arrest, because now I had children and a husband. I was waiting for Ronald Cotton or his family to come and exact revenge. It was only fair. I had wished for him to die violently and cruelly for what I believed he had done to me, so why wouldn't he want me to die for what I had taken from him? On the outside, I seemed to be handling things. I had to. I was raising three young children who knew nothing about what had happened to their mother. But the shame and the anger sometimes suffocated me. My friend Andrea would come on long walks with me, listening to me as I cried and yelled. What was I supposed to do with the shame and the fear and the anger? I had no place to put it, and because I could not fall apart over it overtly, I fell apart over the most innocuous, unrelated things. One evening, as I was trying to get dinner on the table, I was taking hot rice out of the microwave in a glass dish. On autopilot, I used a damp dish towel to hold it, and in seconds the heat shot through the towel to my hand. I let go of the dish, and it hit the open oven door next to me, sending rice and shattered glass all over the kitchen and in the oven. The kids were fighting over watching Pinocchio, and I started weeping hysterically. My husband came in and said, "It's okay. It's only rice. I'll help you clean it up."
"I don't want your help," I yelled. "I'm doing it."
Brittany, Morgan, and Blake came in a few minutes later.
"I'm hungry," they said. "When can we eat?"
I would not let anyone sit down to eat until every last bit of rice was cleaned out of the oven, and I had swept up the glass on the floor. In the fall, when the kids started school, I went to the principal's office. He was a portly man with spectacles and receding hair. He listened kindly as I briefly explained what had happened, that this guy had come out of prison, and I wanted the kids watched. The children were not to go with anybody, I told him. The principal took me very seriously and assured me he would meet with all three of their teachers. I was so angry. I had been going through the world mostly okay. I had volunteered for storytelling hour, had been the Girl Scout Brownie Troop leader. My identity was Brittany, Morgan, and Blake's mom. People hadn't needed to know about my rape, and now I had to tell people not only was I a rape victim, but a rape victim with an extremely bad memory, and someone had to pay 11 years for that. I wondered how I could have been so stupid. One weekend, when I was bringing the kids to visit my brother Joe, I knew we'd pass through Burlington. I called Mike Galden to see if he wanted to meet for coffee. We had breakfast at IHOP, and between meeting Mike and devouring their chocolate chip pancakes, the kids were rapt. He'd wanted to bring them something, but I guess all he could find were ballpoint pens. But ballpoint pens from the policeman, as they called him, made every toy lying around our house pale in comparison. He even offered to give them a tour of the police station. They squealed in delight. "Can we, Mommy? Please?" I called my brother to let him know we'd be later than expected. Mike took the kids to the brand new police building on Front Street. If it had been the same building I sat in all those years ago, I'm not sure I would have been able to walk in. He took the kids through every department. While they had their mug shots taken and were fingerprinted, Mike and I were able to talk a little. The case had haunted him the way it had haunted me, because Mike was a good cop. He told me he had been through the investigation file several times, trying to figure it all out, if there was a place where he had screwed up. He wanted to make sure it never happened again. Mike also told me officers reported seeing Ronald Cotton out and about, and that he seemed to be at peace. He really didn't think I was in any danger. Mike seemed more worried about what I was doing to myself.
Chapter 14. Ronald. The weekend after my exoneration, I went with my family to watch the fireworks in Burlington City Park. It was the 4th of July, 1995, Independence Day. Bobby Leon Poole had been indicted the day before for the rapes of Jennifer Thompson and Mary Reynolds. And while I finally had my innocence, I was a long way from independence. My sister Tootie said I could stay with her and her sons, BJ and Brooks, until I got myself on my feet. Tootie's real name was Marietta, but we never called her that. Ever since she was a baby,